Conducting an orchestra is a mysterious business. The conductor is a commanding figure to the audience as well as the musicians, but also something of an enigmatic one. What is it he's actually doing? Keeping the musicians at the same tempo, cueing in the various sections and soloists, but how does that make him an interpretive artist rather than a glorified crossing guard? Leonard Slatkin is the former music director for the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, the Orchestre National de Lyon. He's currently music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, and he's written a book about what he does called Conducting Business, which gives us an insight into the nuts and bolts as well as the artistic elements of his profession. It's published by Amadeus Press, which is an imprint of Hal Leonard Corporation, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome Maestro Slatkin to our show.
Hello. Very nice to be here.
I understand that you're in town to conduct two concerts at Carnegie Hall Spring Festival.
Yes, we play a concert this evening of music of Rachmaninoff, Kurt
Weill.
Kurt Weill, and then Maurice Ravel. And then tomorrow, the first time ever, the four symphonies, the numbered ones of Charles Ives, will be played in one night.
Oh, wow.
So it's a real opportunity to take this journey and see how one composer began and what roads he took to get to his ultimate voice.
And how he actually stole from himself.
Well, he stole from himself, but he was really, it was injecting hymn tunes, popular music of the time, patriotic melodies. That is what set up him as the first real American composer for the concert hall.
And the Fourth Symphony often requires two conductors, I believe.
Two or three. We'll use two with one of the percussionists leading the offstage group in the last one. I wanted four more, but they said we couldn't afford it.
Now, WQXR, our sister station, is the festival's media partner. We'll be broadcasting the concerts, listeners will be able to hear.
Tune in. 7:30, not 8. 7:30.
You say that the profession of conducting is a relatively new one, something that evolved in the 19th century. Who led the orchestra before that?
Usually the concertmaster. Sometimes the organist, sometimes somebody who just might be there stamping their foot. They actually used to make sound to keep the tempo. There's a famous story of the composer Lully, who had a staff, and he just went pound, pound, pound into the floor, and he missed, and he went through his foot and died of gangrene.
Well, there are still conductorless orchestras, and they seem to do rather well. Are you really needed?
You're needed because somebody has to say, this is how it's going to go. It's the same thing as saying, why does a baseball team need a manager? Or why does the soccer team need a coach? They don't seem to do much. They go out and they argue with the referees. But all of the work is done in the rehearsal process. When you have a group of between 60 to 100 musicians, one person has to take charge and say, this is the way we think it should go.
And at the beginning, wasn't it mostly the composers themselves who did the conducting?
Actually, when you look at music history, what you find is not only were the composers the conductors, they were generally the performers. Chopin is a pianist, Brahms, Beethoven, Paganini is a violinist, so forth and so on. It was really only in the 20th century that the conductor, the role of the conductor, separated out from every other musician on the stage.
Although not always.
No.
We have any number of respected conductor composers, even in the end of the 19th century, somebody like Mahler.
Yes.
But more recently, we have Bernstein and Pierre Boulez.
But they're the rarity. And it's, for the most part now, the people who wrote the music are not the people who are recreating it.
Are they the best people to conduct their own music? Because in theater, it's often there's a big debate over whether the playwright should direct mm-hmm. his own or her own play.
It's obviously a subjective question. I think in the case of the two conductors you mentioned, probably so. However, even Boulez and Bernstein went back and re-looked at their music three times in recordings. So they must have thought something changed as well. Also, of course, there are so many composers who technically just struggle a little bit. They try to get their ideas across by talking about it rather than showing it with their stick or their body.
But wouldn't you love to know how Bach conducted his own music or Chopin or Brahms?
Sure, of course we would.
We have recordings from the early 20th century. How much do you learn from them?
From the early recordings? From any recordings. There's a lot to learn, but not the piece of music itself. Because when you have a work and you study it, you have to form your own set of ideas. After you feel you've absorbed much of this, then it's very helpful to go back and say, okay, how did such and such conductor do this? How did Reiner take this passage? How did Toscanini take it? The critical thing, not just for conductors, but for any musician, when you see that and you say, okay, such and such slowed down here, you have to be able to say, why did they do that? If you can't answer the why question, you have no business even thinking about it.
And sometimes I think you probably, I mean, I imagine you say, he shouldn't have slowed it down.
Well, that's, again, the question, but I do try to get at the real meaning. Why does somebody do something? And for myself, it's always that way. If I'm doing something that goes slightly against the grain of what I have in the text in front of me, the score, I'm going to ask myself, why do I need to do that? Maybe it's because the winds need to take a breath. Maybe it's because the dynamic level doesn't allow the freedom and flexibility of hearing all the voices. Maybe the tempos need to be adjusted for the different acoustics and players. There are lots of things.
But so your goal isn't to be true to the composer's vision?
Well, the goal is to be true to the spirit of the composer. We can't really replicate how something was played. We shouldn't.
Well, we have period instrument orchestras now.
But we have audiences that don't live in that period.
So what's gained and what's lost by playing an 18th century piece with 21st century instruments?
You gain the idea, certainly, that music evolves and it changes. What you lose is how did it sound when the composer wrote it? And none of us can answer the question, what would the composer have thought 100 years later? Would they have accepted the changes? In general, I think the answer is yes. And that question you ask might be more penetrating if we asked today's composers, how will your music sound, do you think, in 100 years? What will change?
And will somebody stop doing repetition when he's conducting Philip Glass?
You know, there was a funny, when the Metropolitan Opera premiered, I think it was called The Voyage, somebody went down at the end of the first act and was talking to a member of the orchestra, and they asked, how long is the second act? And the musician said, well, it'll be about 7 minutes without repeats.
My guest is Leonard Slatkin. His book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro. You once played a Bernstein piece for him, and he took exception to it?
Oh, yes. It was in Tanglewood. We had never met. We were supposed to have met a couple times, but it just didn't work out. And finally, I was conducting the Boston Symphony in Tanglewood, and I thought, if I put a Bernstein piece on, because I knew that he was conducting the day after me, he will show up, and I'll finally meet him. It was the ballet Facsimile, not played very often, and it didn't go so well, I didn't think. Somehow, maybe I was a little bit nervous. It just wasn't what I thought it would be.
I'd imagine conducting Beethoven, knowing that he was in the audience, might make you a little nervous.
No. So Bernstein came back, and I was expecting the worst. I was sure he was just going to do it. And he had no problem criticizing anybody in front of other people. And he looked at me and he said, well, it really wasn't what I intended when I wrote it. And I said, oh, no, here it comes. And then he said, but I think I know how you arrived at your decisions. What he was saying, and it's very important, was he had come to the point in his life that he realized if his music was to survive, it was going to undergo changes in the hands of other interpreters.
But do you think that process is also why some composers like Copland, Stravinsky, and Britten returned to conducting later in their lives?
Well, Copland said he did it for the money. He said it's much easier just to wave your arms instead of putting notes on the page. Stravinsky did it because he wanted documentation, certainly, of how he felt the works could go. Bernstein, because he's a composer also, as well as a performer on so many areas, it's different. I think there was a mystique about the composer doing their own music. But I remember a program I went to when I was a student here in New York where Stravinsky conducted some of his later works, and it was a tepid response from the audience at best. So even the presence of this giant couldn't save the music, which was just at the time considered not so strong.
Pretty much everybody I know has at one time or another imagined what it would be like to conduct an orchestra. You stand there and you move your arms while you're listening to the recording. But what makes a person want to be a conductor? You began as so many conductors, as a pianist.
I began actually as a violinist because my whole family were musicians. And my father played the violin, and I wanted to be like him. So I took that up. And then when I realized I couldn't be like him, I quit. Took up the piano because my uncle played the piano. And then I realized I couldn't be as good as him. And I quit. Then I took up the viola because nobody else in the family played it. And that's when the joke started. After that, I gravitated to composition and finally conducting, even though my dad was a conductor. But he passed away when I was 19. So,
and that freed you to consider becoming a conductor?
It did. I didn't think of it that way at the time, but now I do. We do all harbor that, either to play the drums or conduct. And many of us tap our feet. And I love it. I love the fact that people are still intrigued by the conductor. And the basics of physical conducting are not very difficult.
But it's much more likely for someone who is a pianist or who plays a string instrument than a trombonist or a timpanist to become a conductor.
Although that's changing. There are very fine conductors who come from different worlds now because the repertoire is so broad and so wide. One of the differences that changed in the 20th century and the 21st is the use of winds and percussion is so much more dominant now. And so you see a lot of these players turning to conducting.
The joke is that the way to get to Carnegie Hall is practice, practice, practice. How do you practice as a conductor?
You study. It's alone time. You know, even though you're going to be conducting a piece with 80 to 100 musicians, you're sitting there looking at this piece of music. It's just you and the score. And you get in your mind how you want the piece to go. And then you start evolving the techniques that you want to use for clarity to the orchestra, imitating the phrases, whatever you can do to show the music and in your body, in your physical expression. Then you get in front of the orchestra, and you have to know what to say. Because you say one word that goes the wrong way, you're in big trouble.
They turn against you. And you the first time you conducted the New York Philharmonic, I imagine, was really scary because they have a reputation for being tough on new conductors.
They did back then. I jumped in for Riccardo Muti, and I got up there, and I started in the second clarinetist said, "Excuse me, maestro, I have a question about a note. I know your score is in C, and I'm supposed to play the B-flat clarinet, but I'm doing it on A. What note should I have?" So I just said, "Well, why are you playing on the A clarinet?" And little things like that happened, and I didn't understand it.
They were just challenging
you. They were doing a little testing, and I passed.
Now, you mentioned your family all played music. In fact, your parents formed the Hollywood String Quartet.
They were one half of the Hollywood String Quartet.
Was there any controversy about using that name?
Yeah, there was, but not on their part. The reason for that was because my dad, who was concertmaster at 20th Century, my mom was the first cellist at Warner's, meaning probably everybody listening has heard them at some point, they owed their existence to the income that Hollywood provided. It made it possible to have the quartet, the other two members also being members of studio orchestras. But it also meant, for us, that we had this entree to these worlds of music. It wasn't just classical music.
Well, Frank Sinatra, you say, sang you to sleep
once.
He did. You called him Uncle Frank.
Uncle Frank.
And your father conducted his recordings? I've always thought it was Nelson Riddle or Billy May.
Not all the time. What would happen? Nelson was a great arranger. I mean, one of the top people in that field. But he wasn't such a good conductor. And sometimes Capitol Records would organize for Nelson to go out of town doing concerts with, say, Nat King Cole. And my dad would conduct the sessions because they could get more songs done. Frank relied on my father time and time again. He came to him for advice. Frank studied conducting with my dad. Frank Sinatra made a couple of recordings as a conductor, even though his music reading skills were limited at best.
So much of the conductor's work is done alone, I'd imagine.
It is.
Preparing before you ever go out to rehearsal, you have to have a pretty good idea.
You need a game plan. You need a real game plan for rehearsals. You're limited by the clock. Rehearsals in this country tend to be between 2 and 2.5 hours. You may have 3, maybe have 4 rehearsals per program. You have to figure out exactly how those rehearsals are going to go, allow for the time when mistakes will happen, and how you're going to correct them as efficiently as possible.
And you write here about being so involved with it that you lived a rather insular life. You were near Columbia during a period of great turbulence, and you were totally unaware of it?
I lived at 115th, just off of Broadway. I would walk up the street. Juilliard at the time was on 122nd. And I saw all these people. I didn't know what was going on. It was all that time during Mark Rudd and the Weathermen and all these days of social upheaval. No, for me, it was just when am I doing the Brahms? That's what it was about.
Well, you're now at the Detroit, and you're a musical director and conductor.
Yes.
So what does that mean? Is you like the CEO of the orchestra?
Not the CEO, because I don't deal with that aspect of it. What I am is the person who decides artistically everything that's going to happen, from the guest conductors, the soloists, the programs, everything that goes into the musical element. But I do get involved in fundraising. I do get involved in the finances. Detroit, you must be, of course.
And then you have to determine what's going to be you're going to be playing during the season.
Yes. It's fun for me. It's a puzzle. You know,
did you try to balance old and new?
Of course. You do it like a restaurant would do a menu, where you have some of the really good staples, and then you have things that are signature dishes. A season, it's very much like that. You want the public to have as much variety as possible to choose from.
Now, it's also right now many of the orchestras are dealing with union problems because fewer people are coming to concerts and
not
it's
in Detroit.
Got more expensive.
In Detroit, we've done – we were on strike 2 years ago for 6 months. It was a terrible time, but we've emerged a much stronger institution. Attendance is at an all-time high. Contributions are coming in at record rates, and our public is getting younger.
And you're also at Lyon
in
France.
Yes, which my cardiologist is not happy about.
Because the food is so great.
That's right.
Maestro Slatkin is conducting the Detroit Symphony in two concerts as part of the Spring for Music Festival at Carnegie Hall tonight and tomorrow. QXR is broadcasting these concerts live as well as distributing them nationally. They begin at 7:30. He has a book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro. It is published by Amadeus Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure.